This is On Target St. John's. A look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Good afternoon. It is Carrie Hotter with you here on your VOCM today, having a little bit of an issue connecting with Linda Swain today, which is strange, really, because we've had this system worked out ever since March, since she's been doing the show at home. No problem. She's been doing it absolutely tickety-boo, as they say. But today, I guess it just doesn't want to work out with us. So I'll take on the very first segment of the show, and we'll try and get her back on in just a few moments. So bear with us if you don't mind. Right now, today, we've got a very interesting show, and this is something that Linda is totally interested in. She loves anything that's creepy crawly. Yeah, she loves animals, birds, but she also loves bugs. So today on the air, we are speaking with Dr. Hugh Whitney, the former chief veterinary officer for the province and co-author of Stouts, Millers, and Forky Tales. And we've also got Barry Hicks. He's a scientist and professor at the College of the North Atlantic Carbonear Campus. And guys, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
So, we'll have to try and get Linda on during the next commercial break, but I know some questions that she wanted to ask you, and here we go. We've got a warm start to our beautiful summer. Is that resulting in any increased number of crawling and flying insects?
Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, thanks, Hugh. There's lots of mosquitoes and black flies and I'm finding there's lots of butterflies and stuff out, so it's been a good start of the summer anyway.
And Barry, Dr. Whitney, what do you think about that?
Oh yes, there are lots of bugs out. I have noticed as we get more into mosquitoes. Mosquitoes like it when it's above 10 Celsius, and when I go out walking, I go into the woods when it's below 10. To avoid the mosquitoes, because they're much less active then. So in the last couple of weeks, we've had some days above and some days below, and I certainly notice a difference when it's 10 or below for the mosquito activity.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I was hiking on the Skirwink Trail this past weekend in Port Rexton, and it was just around 10 or 11 degrees, perfect hiking temperature, and I noticed, wow, there's actually no flies. There were no flies bothering me, and let me tell you, flies absolutely love me. Is there a reason why some people get bitten by mosquitoes more than others?
Oh, yes. Some of them are poorly defined and some of them are fairly clear. They're attracted to us by heat and carbon dioxide that we breathe out, and probably some other things that are less well defined. It seems that they like women more than men. They do like body heat. There's some suggestion that blood type is important, though I'm not sure if that's real or not, and possibly how often we bathe. So this may have to be careful about what I say here, but if some of us bathe less often than others, we have a broader variety of bacteria on our skin, which discourages mosquitoes from biting us. So this may be, those who bathe a lot and may have perfumes or shampoo smell in their hair, that may attract mosquitoes more. So not suggesting that you bathe less, but that may be a factor.
That is something that my mom always said growing up, actually, that if you're wearing perfumey things, the flies will be more attracted to you. Is it because they think that you're a flower?
Well, all the difficult questions all pass to Barry.
Well, I don't know in that particular case. I'm not sure. I thought it was just carbon dioxide that they were attracted to.
Okay, interesting. And I've heard other people say that when they eat bananas, it seems like they get more fly bites.
Not too sure about the banana one. I've heard that. I've heard oranges as well. And when I've tried to, I'm involved in a mosquito research project. When I try to dig into this stuff, actually finding scientific evidence of these things is a little bit more difficult than just common knowledge things that spread around. So I'm not too sure about the banana thing.
Okay. I know a lot of people in June, we've been out and about and a lot of people staycationing and stuff because we had a beautiful month in June. And a lot of people noticed a lot more fly bites and a lot more mosquitoes around. But is that due to the warmer temperatures?
Well, guaranteed that flying insects need heat. That's why we don't see them in the winter. And so the warmer it is, the more they're up. But the more you're out, the more you'll be bitten as well. You don't get as many mosquito bites inside your house. So if you're outside, they're out and about. And we're just sort of at the tail end of black fly season. So, you know, there are quite a few black flies around. One interesting thing is that we can become immune to mosquito bites. And you may find if you go to a new place, if you, in another year, say, went to holiday in a place you're not from, you may find the mosquitoes worse there than you do at home. And that's because you do build up a resistance to mosquito bites in your particular region.
I believe that because I have been bitten while down south on vacation, and it seems that I get a much worse reaction from those fly bites than I would here in Newfoundland and Labrador. And as I get older, they don't seem to be as bad either. I remember getting some welts when I was a kid, so that's all because we kind of get used to it. We build up some sort of immunity?
Well, yes, we do build a immunity to some of the things inside, some of the proteins inside mosquitoes when they inject their saliva into us. Yeah, and so little children, it is worse with them.
Okay. Has this warm summer so far had an impact on insect populations?
You go ahead, Barry.
I'm sorry, I was distracted. What was the question again?
Has this warm summer had any impact on insect populations?
Oh, most definitely. I'm finding, you know, people are talking about wasps and bees and that sort of thing. And, you know, the warmer the weather, the faster insects are going to develop. And, people are going to start seeing more.
I was out at cabins just a little while ago, actually, and there was a lot of mosquitoes. And one little girl was out there, and she said, I wish I could ball up every mosquito in the world and fire that ball into the sun, because she was sick of getting bitten, I guess. Is there a reason for them? Do we need them?
Well, it's not always about us.
Yeah.
Mosquitoes, have their own reason for existing, just like the diseases they carry. I don't need them. I don't know about you, Barry, as an entomologist.
Well, I mean, you know, mosquitoes are important as food for other invertebrates in water, and also fish as well, right? So they're quite important to the ecosystem.
Okay.
But what I find is a lot of people think they see a swarm of mosquitoes when actually it's a form of a non-biting fly. And so, you know, a lot of people, you're walking along the trail and you see the swarm and they think it's mosquitoes and they run away, when actually they're just non-biting chironomid flies, and, you know, they won't hurt you at all.
Oh, but they're just a nuisance. You see people swatting away when there's a lot of flies around your head, kind of thing. So you're saying that those flies won't actually bite you?
Well, you know, these chironomids won't be flying around your head, but, you know, if you're some people will walk down a dusty trail and they'll see the swarm of flies in front of them and think it's, you know, a swarm of mosquitoes, when really it's just a non-biting fly that isn't just harmless. And so things people need to think about. There's not all things that look like mosquitoes are biting flies and they're going to harm you.
Huh. Is there...
The swarms that you see around your head, we often don't think much about them other than they are a swarm. But there's a lot of stuff going on in these swarms. You will have male mosquitoes hanging up high in the air. And males don't bite us, but they're waiting for the females to come swarming around you so they can drop down into them and do a bit of breeding. So, you know, it's a whole world going on in these swarms that we don't really know about.
They've got their own little ecosystem going on.
Yeah, their whole social hierarchy.
Is there a reason why they bite humans?
Well, female mosquitoes want blood. That's just like ticks. They need blood to feed their eggs.
Oh.
And so we are a very good source of blood. And there's only, we have like 38 species of mosquitoes in our province. All of them want blood except for one. And many of those, over 20 of them, are more than happy to bite humans. some of them only bite frogs or other things. They need blood, and the more successful mosquitoes are those that are able to take blood from as many different species as possible, because then they have more selection, more chance of survival. So blood is necessary to the development of their eggs for the next generation.
All right, great. Well, I'm going to take a quick break, and we'll try and reconnect with Linda Swain. After all, this is her show. Thankfully, I was here to pop in while we worked out some technical issues. I think those are worked out, and we'll be right back after this break, guys. Stay tuned. This is On Target St. John's.
Now back to Linda Swain, On Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. Well, 4 months into this thing, we've been doing it this way for ever since I've been home in mid-March, and this is the first technical glitch that we've encountered, so it's bound to happen. But I want to thank Carrie Hodder for jumping in there on the fly, so to speak. Pardon the pun. My guests today are Dr. Hugh Whitney. He's a former chief veterinary officer for the province. He's also the co-author of Stouts, Millers, and Forky Tales, and Barry Hicks. He's an entomologist and professor at the College of the North Atlantic Carbonear campus. And I'm going to start with you, Hugh. You've been doing a lot of work, and part of the work you did on the book was on ticks. Now, I'm seeing an awful lot of posts lately from pet owners and others who are talking about an extraordinary number of ticks this season. What is the situation currently with ticks?
Well, I don't have the position I previously had in which I would see things coming into our diagnostic lab and have a feeling for it. So I can't speak from that perspective, but from a general perspective, the ticks that we see on our pets could be a few different ones, presuming that people aren't traveling with their pets these days, which is pretty safe assumption. We're not seeing ticks that are coming back from somewhere else. But what we tend to see on our pets from this province are possibly the black-legged tick, which is one we all worry about, but a variety of other ones like the mouse tick, the squirrel tick, the vole tick, which are just sort of they're out there, but they don't cause a problem, and more or less often on cats, the rabbit tick. So rabbit ticks, for example, there's tons of them in the woods, and people who trap rabbits or snare them will be quite familiar with seeing hares covered in these ticks. So it's not surprising to find ticks.
I take it from the names of these creatures that they are specific to specific animals, hosts?
Well, yes and no. The deer tick or black-legged tick, the one we worry about the most, is very much a generalist. It's happy to feed off of numerous different species, across mammals, reptiles, birds. The white-tailed deer is very important for it, but its early stages of life are more than happy to take blood from a number of different species of animal. The other ones, and without getting too technical about it, these are ticks that tend to live close to the burrow in which their normal host lives. So a mouse tick tends to live around the nest where the mouse lives. The vole tick, same thing. We have seabird ticks, which tend to live around the nest or the burrow of the seabird. But if other animals come around, and dogs and cats, we see some of these on them, because no doubt they're out in the woods and sticking their nose or following their nose to the smells of these potential prey animals. So, you know, it's not surprising that a mouse tick can be found on a cat or a rabbit tick on a cat, because those are generally animals that a cat might be sniffing down.
Now, you mentioned the black-legged tick or the deer tick. Why is this such a concern?
Yes, well, this is in our part of the world, the most important spreader of Lyme disease, which is a very significant human illness, and it also can cause illness in dogs. Humans are more susceptible than dogs are, but dogs can get sick from it. And it is a climate change disease, so it is where in the 90s we only saw it in Point Pelee Provincial Park in Ontario that was dipping into the Great Lakes, one of the most southern parts of Canada. Since then, it has been expanding northwards so that there are permanent populations in many provinces that didn't see them before. And into the Atlantic provinces, New Brunswick and Nova Scotia both have permanent populations of these ticks. PEI, I believe, is like us that only sees ticks arriving on migratory birds. Without going too far into this, the presence of white-tailed deer are very important because, as one of their names suggests, deer tick, this is the species on which most of the mating happens between the male and the female black-legged tick. So without that animal around, you may not be able to establish permanent populations.
So it requires that host in order to establish itself.
Right, and that's the other reason that it's considered to be expanding into the further into Canada, the climate change, but also hunting has gone down, hunting of deer from generation to generation, and there's a lot of farmland that has been left to go wild, and not necessarily in this province. It is happening here, but it's happening in other many areas as well. So it expanded rapidly in the New England states of the U.S. because farmland cleared during European settlement has gone back to woods, which has provided very good habitat for the white-tailed deer to live in. I traveled to Quebec quite a bit, and the numbers of white-tailed deer that you see driving through the country where there used to be farmland is incredible. It's not rare to see 100 at a time.
We do not have white-tailed deer here. Will that help to protect us?
My opinion, yes. There are white-tailed deer on St. Pierre Miquelon, it's on Miquelon and Long Lad, those two islands. And so they have a potential. They don't have a high density of deer. It's suggested that you need 7 per square kilometer to maintain these ticks. But they might see it before us. But climate is limiting for us. They need heat just like mosquitoes and any other arthropod to survive. And to complete their cycle, these black-legged ticks need probably a minimum of 2 years. But if they're not getting the heat, they may all die off before they are able to complete their cycle. So temperature is very important, and we are still outside of the temperature range considered necessary to successfully complete their cycle.
So that's the expansion of one type of creature, but we've seen invasive species here in Newfoundland and Labrador, and Barry Hicks has done some research on a particular invasive species. Barry, what can you tell us about fire ants?
Well, the European fire ant, as the name suggests, originates Western Europe, and it's been introduced into North America around 1900 around the Boston area, and from then on it moved northeastwardly, getting into Maine and eventually into Nova Scotia. I think in Nova Scotia got there in the early 90s, and then in around 2010 we found it here in Newfoundland. And originally, we thought, well, it's just following along, you know, it's moving up the East Coast and eventually made its way to Newfoundland. But some of the research that I've done has shown that the ants that we have here in Newfoundland actually came directly from Britain instead of coming the other way from the mainland. And we have populations now established in St. John's. Much of St. John's now has fire ants, and then we have populations around Conception Bay and communities of Conception Bay. And then the only other place in Newfoundland besides on the Avalon is over in Cornerbrook, where I found two populations, one around the Glenlyn Pond in Cornerbrook and another one on Country Road in Cornerbrook.
So what is a fire ant, and how do they differ from your typical black ant, for instance?
Okay, so, well, really, it's not really a fire ant. When people talk about fire ants, they may think about those terrible ants that they get down in Florida and Texas and those places. those particular ants in those areas are known as the red imported fire ants, and those are considered fire ants. This one, this European fire ant, the name was coined by the popular literature down in the States, and of course, in the popular literature, they like to, you know, name things, give them fantastic names. So they start with the European fire ant, but it really all it is a little red ant that stings. And now the problem with it is that it stings readily. It'll sting anything that gets too close to its nest, and people that have this ant in their garden cannot enjoy their gardens at all. You can't go out in bare feet or in sandals or anything like that, or go lie in your grass or like that. You can't do it because the fire ants will come up and sting you. So the issue is the sting. You know, a lot of people say they bite. Well, yeah, they can bite, but the bite is, they're only little tiny ants, so it's not, that's not going to cause the pain. It's the actual sting, which is like a wasp sting, where it injects venom, and that venom then causes a burning sensation.
So do they swarm?
Well, the way that their nests are made, they have really large nests. In a lot of cases, the nests will encompass your entire neighborhood, and then they'll have hundreds of satellite nests. And then those satellite nests may only be a meter apart or something like that. And each satellite nest will have multiple queens, too. So this is the other issue. People talk about, well, you know, you can kill these ants by, you know, giving them some borax and sugar and stuff like that, and it'll kill the queen, and then the population will die. Well, that's not the case with these fire ants. These fire ants have multiple queens. So if you kill one of the queens, it doesn't matter. It's got extra queens there to lay more eggs and produce more offspring. So these are really difficult to control. And they're really troublesome in people's gardens.
It's one thing to be, you know, to try and control it from a personal property perspective, but it's a whole other thing when it comes to possibly affecting local populations. Is it doing so?
Most definitely, yeah. The research has been done to show that these invasive ants, in the case this European fire ant, reduces native ant populations. So they basically outcompete the native ants. They're not necessarily fighting with the ants. I mean, they do. They can fight with other, you know, different species of ants. But basically, their numbers go up so quickly that they can take over an area and basically exploit food in one particular area, and that basically eliminates all the other native ants in that area.
And does that affect other flora and fauna?
Almost definitely, yeah. I mean, what you're going to find is that the fire ants are going to feed on other invertebrates in the garden. So they're going to take away the predators of other insects. One example would be aphids. Aphids are the little green insects that are in your maple trees, I'll say, as an example. And European fire ants like to farm these things. So the fire ants will actually climb up the tree, and they'll go to where the aphids are, and they'll keep away the predators, so things like ladybugs and stuff like that, they'll keep them away. And in the meanwhile, they'll go over to the aphid, and they'll tap the aphid on its back, and the aphid will produce something that's called honeydew out of his rear end, which is basically just sap, so sugar water, and the ant will go in behind and lap up this sugar water as a carbohydrate source. So what you're going to find in areas where there's lots of fire ants, they're going to have problems with aphids.
Very interesting indeed. Barry Hicks, a local entomologist. He's with the College of the North Atlantic at the Carbonear campus. And Dr. Hugh Whitney, he's a former chief veterinary officer for the province and the co-author of Stouts, Millers, and Forky Tales. And we're talking about some of the, I'll say, creepy crawlies, but they're denizens of this province for sure, as any other animal would be. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
And we're back. My guests today are Dr. Hugh Whitney. He's the former chief veterinary officer for the province. He's also the co-author of Stouts, Millers, and Forky Tales. And Barry Hicks is an entomologist and professor at the College of the North Atlantic Carbineer campus. And we've been talking about insects in Newfoundland and Labrador, some that have expanded their range into the province, some that are invasive species. But we're going to talk about some endemic species now. Dr. Hugh Whitney, you're involved with something called the NL Mosquito Project. What is that?
Yes, this is a project run through Memorial University to try to get better understanding about the mosquito species that live in this province, as well as the viruses, the diseases that they may carry. This started in 2018, and last summer, 2019, was a big summer for collection. And we reached out to the public to ask that they assist, and this is generally called citizen science, when you look for the participation of willing volunteers. So we would give them a little manual vacuum that they could use called a pooter, and when a mosquito would land on them, they would suck it up into this tube and then send that tube to us for so that we could identify the mosquito species and then look for viruses. We've identified all the mosquitoes. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, what did you find?
Well, we have confirmed, we have, I think, 38 species in the province of mosquito, but just as a starter, this province is so large and there's so many areas that are difficultly accessible, there must be more that we just don't know about. So we can only know what we know, but the participation of all these volunteers has certainly broadened our reach. We had from Okok in northern Labrador to Labrador West down the Straits. We even had volunteers from St. Pierre-Miquelon collect mosquitoes. So we have found mosquitoes that we knew existed here, but we also have increased our understanding of the distribution of some fairly important ones. And to add on to what Barry was just saying about a European species, this province is the most Europeanized place for insects in all of North America. So our insect fauna here has a much higher percentage of European species than you'll find elsewhere because of the extensive trade back and forth over hundreds of years with various parts of Europe. So the European fire ant certainly is an example, but one that in our mosquito project we were quite interested to look at is called the Asian bush mosquito. Latin name Aedes japonicus. It comes out of Asia and has successfully spread around much of the northern hemisphere. So we weren't aware of its existence until about 10 years ago. It was found in the St. John's area, but we have now found it further west, still mostly in eastern Newfoundland, but this is a species that must have come here in some sort of container. Don't know whether it was in a boat, don't know whether it was in a truck, whether it was in a plane. You can't go backwards that well. It is related to ones that exist in Quebec and Ontario, where it has been for quite a long time. But it's a very interesting find. It's a very aggressive mosquito species, as some of them that we have are, a very aggressive biter, a vicious biter. Can spread disease, but we have not found any diseases in it to date. So that's a fairly interesting mosquito for us to continue to follow. And another one that's probably more important is called the northern house mosquito, or Latin name is Culex pipiens. This is the one that in eastern North America or eastern Canada is the most significant in the spread of West Nile virus. We had found it in some research we were involved in the early 2000s, because West Nile virus entered North America in the late 1990s in New York is where it was first found. And if people were trying to figure out how far this is going to expand, to a certain degree, like we're watching COVID-19 expand, a new virus entering North America, everybody was trying to figure out what's going on in their own backyard. So we got involved in research to try to find out what mosquitoes and viruses and risks we had, and found this mosquito for the first time, the northern house mosquito, on the west coast of the island in the generally Cornerbrook-Cormac area. Since then, we have found it on the Avalon, and during the mosquito project, we found it in the Gander area as well. So we know we have the mosquito, one of the most important ones for spreading West Nile virus. We may not have the temperatures at the present time to permit it to spread. So that's a fairly important study. And because of COVID, we have not been able to complete the virus work at the university since it's been shut down. We'll be looking to see what we may find when everything's open again.
So the spread of this northern house mosquito here in Newfoundland and Labrador, is that part of extending its natural range because of warmer temperatures?
Well, part of it is just doing the research in the first place, because you don't really know what's here and how long it's been here if you don't look, and if you don't look over a period of time. The first time we found it was in the early 2000s, but might it have been here before? Don't know. Again, with a very, very large province that we have and few people in it, our research tends to be rather spotty. We look around the most heavily populated areas. We look at areas which are accessible. So a lot of research in this province is done along the Trans-Canada Highway because that's accessible. But what's going on in the core of the island? You know, so we can say that it is probably due to the normal spread of that mosquito, but you can't exaggerate what you understand about these species, because we don't really have super long-term research on it.
Barry, you also study bees, is that correct?
Yes, I do, yep.
So what can you tell us about our native bee species?
Well, we have about 80 different species of bees, native bees here in Newfoundland. And, you know, when people speak of bees, the first thing they think of is a bumblebee, maybe. Really, we don't. We have about 11 species of bumblebee. And of those, there's probably only four that are common. And then there are a number of those bumblebee species that are parasites of other bumblebees. So, you know, typically there's you know, four or five that are commonly seen. But all the other species of bees are little tiny things that people don't even recognize as bees. You know, some people think they're little ants with wings.
I've seen little tiny bees, not super tiny, but, you know, they still hold that same form, the stripes on the abdomen and all that sort of thing. Are those important for pollination?
Oh, most definitely. All those other species besides the bumblebees are the main pollinators of our plants. And, they're doing the job. Bumblebees are also important. But it's mainly all those other species that are very tiny bees that are out doing the work. I've had many instances, been on farms, blueberry and cranberry farms with farmers, and you know, I'm standing there with them and we're saying, gee, there's not very many bees around. And then I say, no, look, there's lots of bees. And we look down on the flowers and there's these little tiny bees, you know, the ones that people don't recognize as bees. And, you know, the farmer would say, oh, I didn't even know they were bees, type of thing. Those are all solitary bees, so they nest in the soil and are very important for pollinating our native plants.
So the honeybee that we're familiar with, how many species of that do we have?
Well, there's only one species of honeybee. And that's Apis mellifera, which is the Western honeybee. Comes from Europe, basically. And this is the one that's grown by beekeepers, or kept by beekeepers. It's not a native species to North America and to many places on the planet, actually. Here in Newfoundland, we're lucky in that our climate restricts the populations of honeybees, and that we don't have feral populations or wild populations of honeybees. Now, that's being challenged in the last couple of years. People have been finding honeybees inside cavities and in buildings and stuff like that. But we have yet to find a honeybee colony that's like in a log or something, or in a hollow in a tree or something like that. And if that happens, we'll be in trouble.
So the vast majority of honeybees that we see are actually cultivated. They're agricultural bees.
Yeah, all the honeybees. All honeybees that you see out there would come from a beekeeper that's nearby.
So why would that be a concern then if they become feral?
Well, the issue is the diseases that are found on bees. And right now, many of your listeners will know that Newfoundland is touted as being a fairly disease-free population of honeybees on the globe. And it really has to do with the fact that we're an island and we've controlled the import of honeybees since the 1980s, the early 1980s. And so while the rest of the world have bee diseases that are decimating the honeybee populations, here in Newfoundland, we don't have the same disease problems that we see in other places. Now, not only diseases, but also pests of these honeybees. So things like varroa mite and tracheal mite and small hive beetle and all these things, these are all pests that can get into the colonies and wreak havoc and basically destroy honeybee colonies. The problem with the varroa mite is that it takes it basically feeds on the blood of the honeybee, and in the process, they transmit viral diseases and other types of diseases. So if you have a feral or a wild population of honeybees, and we get an introduction of varroa mite into the province, which we hope never happens, but it may, you never know. But if it does happen, and if we have wild honeybees flying around, well, basically the diseases are going to go everywhere, and we're not going to be able to control the diseases at all.
People often mistake, from a distance at least, bees and wasps. What can you tell us about wasps?
Well, in the case of wasps, typically when people are, talking about wasps, they talk about the yellow jacket wasp, right? The one that stings people, that produces that paper nest underneath your eave of your house or something like that. Well, those yellow jacket wasps, we have 10 species of yellow jacket wasps in the province. Most of them nest in the ground, by the way, or close to the ground. There's only a couple that nest high up, and like, that you see on the eave of your house. Most are in the ground. Those things are feeding on other invertebrates, like caterpillars and stuff like that. Their population builds up over the summer. It's only the queen, the new queen, that overwinters. And then she initiates a new hive or a new colony in the spring. Well, here in Newfoundland, it's July, like early July, late June. From that one queen, she starts to have a brood of those 7 or 8 workers. And then after that, the workers are the ones that are going out collecting the caterpillars to feed the babies. And over the summer, the population of workers builds up and builds up. The nest gets bigger and bigger and bigger until, September, when there might be a couple of thousand wasps, depending on the species, there might be a couple of thousand wasps in that hive.
Wasps don't overwinter. They're produced every spring. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically all of the workers die, and that nest that you will see basically disintegrates. They don't reuse the nest. So it's only the new queens. So the old queen dies, all the workers die in the fall, and it's only the new queens that are produced in the fall. They're the ones, they mate at that time, and then they go and hide away somewhere. I find that they hide away in my garage, basically tucked away somewhere. They'll stay there all winter until, the next June, and then you'll see activity. And that new queen then is going out, she's finding food for herself, and she's trying to find a place to build a nest. And, of course, that first nest, and lots of people will recognize this, starts off as only about the size of a ping pong ball or a golf ball. And that's the nest that she builds. She only wants to get you know, 7 or 8 workers, you know, out first in the first brood. And after that, she doesn't leave the nest. All the workers do the rest of the work.
So that would explain then why we tend to see so many wasps in September month, for instance.
Most definitely. Well, I find, too, like we get a lot of calls or a lot of activity on Facebook, you know, in June, early July, and they're saying, oh, my God, the wasps are so big, right? They're monsters. I've never seen them so big. And I try to explain, well, those are the queens. The queens are always bigger wasps. And those queens are the overwinter queens. And they're going around now to collect caterpillars or, you know, prey to feed those first few worker babies that she's got in their little colony. And then it takes probably 3 weeks for that first brood to emerge as adults. So there's going to be a time when that big queen is the only one that's going to be flying around. And then once the new workers emerge, then you'll see more and more wasps around. They won't be as big, and, you know, they'll build up over the summer. And then in the fall, what happens? There's not very many caterpillars around, and there's a big population of adults in the nest. So they're trying to look for food, but the food is dwindling. And so what they have to do is go and look elsewhere. And that's when you'll find them entering your house to look for food. Or, you know, if you're having a picnic, they'll be around, you know, looking to steal stuff from your picnic.
You know, here's Newfoundlanders in fall. They seem to bump into a lot of things and be all around you.
Yes. Well, in the fall, too, the weather is getting colder. And, of course, insects require heat to, you know, to move around. If it's colder, they're not moving as fast, and they're not as active. I'm sorry, Linda, I didn't hear that.
Yeah, Linda's phone is just kind of dropping out on us there. I know what she's going to ask you guys. She's going to say, do you guys have some final thoughts now? We've got a couple minutes left of the show. And first, Mr. Hicks will ask you, what are your final thoughts on this topic?
Well, I just, you know, when I get on radio and stuff, I always talk about the fire ants, and I'm always interested in finding out if there are people out there with fire ants. You know, I'm trying to track them in the province. The other issue is that, you know, people are asking me, how do I get rid of them? There's not a whole lot you can do. There are some home remedies and stuff that may be effective, and there are some insecticides that, you know, a pest control company might be able to use, but they're really difficult to control, and, you know, I'm not quite sure how to answer that sometimes.
All right. Thank you very much. And now also we'll ask you the same thing there, Dr. Hugh Whitney. What would your final thoughts on this subject be?
I'd say that Barry Hicks is the administrator of a Facebook group called Insects of Newfoundland and Labrador. Very interesting. And it's a place for people who don't know that much to share what they are seeing in their own gardens or out in the woods or wherever with other people, and it gives a very good opportunity to share information on what's here, and for those with a particular research interest to see that certain species may exist elsewhere, that outside of where they thought they would. So those who are on Facebook, you'd want to consider joining the Insects of Newfoundland and Labrador Facebook group.
Thank you guys very much. On behalf of Linda Swain and myself, Carrie Hotter, thank you very much, Dr. Hugh Whitney and Barry Hicks. Much appreciated.
You bet.
You're welcome.